Hi, my name's Lois, and I'm a very grateful member of the Monday Night North Shore Al-Anon Family Group. It's great, indeed, a privilege for me to have a chance to introduce this lovely lady to you this morning. Some of you may wonder how we have, how we come across speakers, tapes, and are able to choose our speakers. And we have sort of funny little way that we came up with Marcy. It's my sponsor and myself back in May were trying to figure out where we could get some real new tapes and new blood to bring to our convention this year. And we were going on separate vacations and over a period of 9 weeks between the two of us. And it's funny, with Marcy's tape, she was at a meeting in Little Rock, Arkansas. And she asked if anyone there could possibly give her a suggestion on a real excellent speaker for our North Shore Roundup. And simultaneously, just spontaneously, they all answered in unison, Marcy W. And the next day, she was sitting in Dallas with her husband having dinner with some people that the four of us had met at a convention in Vernon, B.C. And she asked her if they'd ever heard Marcy. And she said, why, of course, she's my sponsor. So we ended up with two tapes of Marcy's, and along with eight or nine others, and the committee went over them, and Marcy came up to be the one that we would like to have you all hear this morning. This lady is 30 years in the program, and I must say I certainly admire her. She is very, very active after all this time. She was around before it was Al-Anon, when it was still called the Family Wives Group. She is a past delegate. She's very active in service, started numerous conferences and other things, and I'm sure you're all very anxious to hear her. How about we give her a big Vancouver welcome? Marcy.
Hi, everybody. My name is Marcy White, and I'm a recovering Al-Anon.
Hi, Marcy.
Grateful to be here. Before I get into my talk this morning, I would like to tell you how beautiful your city is and how surprised I was to find out that I would come to Canada and miss the cold weather in Texas. Before AA was ever born, my father needed AA. My mother needed Al-Anon, and I needed Alateen. My father drank, and I did not know why he drank or what was the matter with him, but I never knew what to expect. He would either let me do things that were unreasonable for a child to do, or I couldn't do anything. My life was never on an even keel. I was an only child. And I made a decision that I would never drink, and I would never marry anybody that drank. And you know what I did. I married an alcoholic. I did not know that my husband drank. We were in high school together, and I went off for 2 years of college and missed him. And he came to the dorm to see me several times, and he was tall and good-looking. And the girls said, where have you hidden him? And I started looking at him again and thought, my goodness, maybe I've really got something here. I fell in love and married my husband, Bob. And for the first 15 years of our marriage, he drank. And he was a rip-roaring, wild drunk and fun and exciting and would promise me the moon and probably couldn't pay the rent. I had left Bob after 15 years of marriage. I had given up that he would ever be okay and that we could ever have anything in the marriage. And after I left him, made the decision to leave, I wrote his parents a letter and told them the truth. I quit covering up and protecting him and pretending that everything was okay. And with this letter, they found him in Jackson, Mississippi. We had gone on a geographical cure from Midland, Texas to Denver, Colorado, and had lived there the last 3 years of his drinking. And he had gone to Jackson, Mississippi, and had been gone about 3 months, supposedly working. He was sort of in the oil business. And news trickled back to me that he wasn't down there working. He was laid up in the hotel drunk. And I made the decision that I could not go on the way I had been and that it was time to leave. We had three children, and those three children had kept me tied in the marriage because of security, that, you know, I kept waiting around the corner for the checks to come in so I'd have something to leave on. And it just didn't work that way. And finally, I got desperate enough that I knew that it was going to be necessary for me to go to work and support the three children. And by that time, he had become more of a problem to me than all three of the girls put together. I felt like that he was 6'2", weighed 225 pounds, and I felt like I was babysitting with a baby giant. And I just knew that I could not go to work and support myself and try to take care of three children and try to take care of him, too. So I told his mother and father that I was turning him back over to them, that I had had it. They were able to get him home from Jackson, Mississippi, to the farm in South Texas. And they took him to a psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist said that he drank because of his terrible war experiences. He was a pilot, a prisoner of war. And that he would need to go into a mental institution for at least a year and a half before he would be able to associate in society and drink normally again. By this time, I had a pretty good idea he was an alcoholic, because I had had two AAs come to me that were just had a room in a motel next to us in Greeley, Colorado, that they just barely knew him. And they got me off to the side and asked me if I knew my husband was an alcoholic. And I was ashamed, I was embarrassed, and I remember my answer. I said, well, I know he drinks too much, and I know that he might be on the fence. And if he doesn't quit, he could be alcoholic. And they told me things that he would start doing if he hadn't already started doing them. They told me about blackouts, and I didn't even know about blackouts. I just thought he was going crazy. And I realized that one night when he was sitting on the side of the bed taking off his shoes and socks, he was carrying on a conversation with a lot of people that I couldn't see. And he insisted that I go and serve them drinks. And I was crazy enough that I served them drinks. And he wouldn't get off my back till I served him the drinks. And when I served him the drinks, well, he was fine. And he would have me get up in the night and turn off the radio and shut that music off. And he heard all kind of things I didn't hear. And he saw all kind of things I didn't see. And so I didn't know he was in a blackout. I just thought he was crazy. They also told me he would start sneaking drinks. And I said, oh, he wouldn't do that. He leaves the bottle on the kitchen cabinet, and I let him drink. I just say, don't drink so much. Don't drink when the party's over. They explained to me that he would start sneaking drinks, whether he had a bottle on the kitchen counter or not, because he would not want me to know how much he drank. He would not want anybody else to know how much he drank. He wouldn't even want himself to know how much he drank. And very soon, I found him sneaking drinks. So I knew he was an alcoholic. But at that time, there wasn't Al-Anon. That was over 30 years ago, probably 31 years ago. And with that, I thought there was no hope for me. And I just branded him an alcoholic, and I thought he had to go for help, and there wasn't anything for me to do but leave. And that was the reason that I reached my bottom and decided there was no way for us to go on. So I left and wrote the parents a letter, and they took him to the psychiatrist, and I made my plans to go on with my life. And as it happened, there wasn't any way for me to go on with my life except to go home to my mother and father, because I didn't have any money to do anything. So I went home to my father, who was a practicing alcoholic that I did not know that he was. I just knew he drank and had lost a job and couldn't get another one, and had fallen down in the alley with convulsions, had been taken to a hospital and had been told that he'd never walk again, that the drinking had damaged the locomotive cells in his brain. But I did see him with, I guess, the strongest will that I've ever seen in a human being, determined that he would walk again. And he got up on his feet, and he would hold on to my mother, and he would take a step, just one step, and fall. And then he would get up, and he would take another step. And he learned to walk, just like a baby learns to walk. But he had a shuffle. But you know what? That didn't stop him from drinking. He went right on drinking. But I had seen all this, and he had called me one day and had told me about somebody had come in and was ruining his house. And they had written these words with red paint all over the walls, and this was while Bob was still drinking, and I had no idea what was the matter with him. And we ran over there, and Bob was recuperating from a drunk and was on a crutch. And my father took me in all these rooms and told me all these things were written on the walls, and I couldn't see a thing. And he said, "Look out." I said, "What for?" He said, "Don't step on those dogs." And there were dogs all over the floor. And he sat in his chair, and he looked out the window, and he started laughing and cheering. And there's a sandstorm outside. You couldn't see a thing. He was watching a ball game. And this is the kind of crazy stuff that I just didn't know what to do with. And my mother put him in a hospital, and they locked him up in one of those rooms, you know, that's no doorknobs to get out. And the same day, he was back in his drinking room in his pig pen. And she called the hospital to see how Mr. Wyatt was, and they said, "Oh, he's just fine. You don't have a thing to worry about." And he'd already gotten out. We never knew how he got out. So we had some crazy stuff going on, and I didn't know enough to know that they were suffering from the disease of alcoholism. I just thought they were crazy. And it was a little hard when I got here for me to take the second step, because, you know, I wasn't the crazy one. They were the crazy one. And I didn't think I needed to be restored to sanity. I thought they needed to be restored to sanity. I found out, I'm getting ahead of myself. When I moved back home to Midland with my parents, with three girls, my husband called me the first day that I was there. Now, I thought he was already locked up in the mental institution. And I was really relieved because I wouldn't have him on my hands any longer. And I thought, they can take care of him. I can't do it any longer. And to my utter amazement, when I saw him, he looked about 10 years younger. The bloat was gone out of his face. The redness was gone. His hair wasn't as gray. And he told me that he had been a member of Alcoholics Anonymous for 6 weeks. And he was on the waiting list to get into the mental institution. They had a bumper crop that year, and he couldn't get in. But in the meantime, AA came to see him, and they made a 600-mile round trip to carry the message to him. And that was a miracle. And they took him to meetings in Waco, Texas, and they stayed with him 3 nights and 3 days and got him on the road to recovery. And he had a sponsor named Henry that lived in Midland, Texas, where I had gone home to my mother and father. And Henry had said, "I think you should come back to your hometown where you messed up and walk the streets sober. Everybody's seen you drunk at the country club. Now I think everybody needs to see you sober. And you need to make your amends in that town, and that's where you need to be." So that's the reason he was back. I thought that I was going to leave him. I had plans in my mind to get a divorce, but I didn't have the money or the energy or the know-how to do anything about it at the time. My mother took one look at me, and she says, "You can't try to go to school or get a job and go to work. You have got to take care of yourself." I had lost about 15 or 20 pounds, and I was, had cricks and aches and pains in my neck and my shoulders, and I looked pretty bad. So I promised her that I would not do anything for a month. That night, when Bob came to call on me, it was entirely different than any meeting that we had had before. He told me that he had a job, and for years he had told me that he couldn't get a job. And he offered me some money, and we had been fighting over money for years. I did not know what it took for this man to do what he did. But he went back to a company that he had owned and lost because of his drinking and asked for a job as a salesman. It took me a long time to get well enough and get outside of myself enough to know what that must have taken from him, the courage that it took. And I think he was making $600 a month then, and he offered me $500 of that money. And said that I didn't have any business living there with my mother and father with three children, and for me to take that money and get an apartment and move out. And I took him up on the offer and took the money and moved out and left him out in the cold. And I did not intend to ever go back to him. But in the meantime, the AA started calling on me. I never heard from an Al-Anon because there wasn't Al-Anon. There were wives of the alcoholics. And they had the family wives group going. But the AAs were the ones that came and called on me and told me how well he was doing, wanted me to come to a meeting, and I refused. After about a month, Henry, Bob's sponsor, called and asked me if I would come to dinner. And he had been so nice to me that I really didn't like myself, the way I was putting him off and the way I was treating him. I was so cold and frozen inside that I was keeping everybody out here, and I would not accept any help from anyone. But I accepted the dinner engagement just because I didn't like the way I had treated Henry. And after a few minutes of conversation, he said, "By the way, Bob's coming too. Is it okay if he picks you up?" And I said, "Well, of course, we're on speaking terms, and I would be glad for him to pick me up." So we went to dinner. And there were the three men that had made the 12-step call on Bob and the three wives for dinner. And I was surprised. And they had to put on the best for me. They had the white linen tablecloth on the table and the silver and the crystal and the china, and I was impressed. And I needed to be impressed because, you see, I thought alcoholics were all Skid Row bums that slept under park benches, you know, or in the gutter. And I had no idea that alcoholics were like they were. And I began to enjoy myself. And I thought, well, this is going to be pretty nice after all. And after dinner, I pushed my chair back and lighted a cigarette and began to relax. And they said, "By the way, we're all going to a meeting tonight. Wouldn't you like to go?" Well, that was the last thing I wanted to do, was go to a meeting. But one of my defects that I have found is that I always conformed resentfully. So I conformed resentfully, and I went to the meeting. And I was amazed. I liked what I saw, and I liked what I felt, and I knew that I knew I didn't have to lie anymore. I knew I didn't have to cover up anymore. I knew that I could be myself. And I knew they accepted us just like we were. And I didn't have to be ashamed, and so there was some freedom for me with that first meeting. But I wasn't going to go back because I wasn't going to let anybody talk me into taking him back. So I wouldn't go. My twin girls, who were 8 years old at the time, had an effect on me going back to my husband. One day they came to me with tears in their eyes and said, "Mommy, why can't Daddy live with us anymore?" And I got sort of nervous, and I said, "Well, we've just got this little two-bedroom apartment, and there's not room. You have one room, and Sandy and I, the older daughter, have the other room, and there's no room for Daddy." And they looked up at me with tears in their eyes and said, "Mommy, if you'll let Daddy move back in with us, we'll sleep on the couch and let Daddy have our room." And that got me. That got me. But for years, I used that as an excuse, the reason that I went back to Bob. And the truth was, I really wanted to, but I had gotten myself in a corner, and I didn't know how to get out. And so I used them as a reason to go back to him. I was standing up making an Al-Anon talk one time and knew I was lying when I was telling that story, and I had to correct myself. But that was I had told myself that lie, which I know today is I was not being emotionally honest with myself. And it took me a long time to get this emotional honesty with myself, to see the truth that sets us free. Also, one time Bob was trying to bring some clothes into the apartment. I had an empty closet, and he was living out of his car and sleeping in a little flea bag motel and living on a little bit of nothing so we could have a place to live. And I looked around, and he had an armload of his clothes bringing them in the apartment, and I just panicked. I just panicked. I thought he was moving back in, and I said, "What in the hell are you doing with all those clothes?" And he just stood there, just frozen. He was, I guess, with my venom. And he said, "Well, my clothes are just ruining in the back of the car, and I thought maybe you would let me hang them in the closet. And I said, I'll do no such thing. Get them out of here right now. I don't want to even see them. Now, that's the kind of person I had become. And I didn't like myself at all. And that made me see that there was something the matter with me. After a month or two went by, Bob asked me one night if I would go to a meeting with him. And I went. And after that meeting, he asked if he could come up to the apartment and have a talk. And we did. Now, I did not have a program that I was living by, and he did. And what he was doing that night, which I did not know, he was taking the ninth step with me. He was making his amends to me. And he began to tell me all the things that he had done that he was sorry for, that he wished could have been different. And he explained to me why he did the way he did. And then after he got through, he said, "What else have I done?" And I let him have it with both barrels. All that stuff that I had pushed down inside of me that I didn't think I could ever forgive or forget, I let it all hang out. I wondered, after I was in the program, why I did it that way. And then I saw that I was always afraid I would lose him. I had a fear of abandonment because of my relationship with my alcoholic father. And I never said it like it was because I was a people pleaser. And I wanted everybody to like me, and I wanted him to love me. And so I couldn't stand the thought that of me telling him exactly how I felt, because I knew he'd leave. So I had no freedom to be me. And I saw in the program that only when the chips were down and I didn't care could I tell it like it was. And that's the reason that I told it like it was, because I didn't care. I didn't care anymore. And to my utter amazement, he didn't yell and holler, and I didn't cry. And we were communicating. And he was understanding where I was coming from, and I was understanding where he was coming from. And all of that heavy burden, and all of the fear, and all of the hate, and all the resentments just were lifted from my shoulders that night when he took the time and cared enough to explain to me, well, the reason he came in the door, 6 hours late, jumping on my case, was to keep me from jumping on his. And things that I thought that I never would be able to forgive or forget were gone, just literally gone. And then after we went through that, then he said to me that he had a few things to talk to me about, things that I had done that he didn't like. And, he had set the pace, and I followed suit. It's not that I wanted to, but I wouldn't dare lose my temper and cry and scream when he was acting so nice. So I sat there and I followed suit, and we got everything out on the table. The big book says that we clear away the wreckage of our past, and we cleared away the wreckage of our past marriage so we could build anew on a firm foundation. And there was so much that had gone on, there was no way we could have made it if we hadn't done that. For years and years in the program, we have advised people to do that, to clear away the wreckage of their past marriage, to sit down and write it all out. And we ask them to get an understanding couple to listen in. We did not have that, and it worked fine for us. But we started telling them to just do it like we did, and sometimes, they get in another fight. So it's better if you have a referee, we found out, and it's better to get it all cleared so that you are free of the old ideas and all the old garbage that you've built up in years of marriage. So you do have an opportunity to start anew and build a firm foundation in a marriage with this program, and you certainly can do it, because we did. It wasn't long after that until we moved in a house, and I started going to Al-Anon. It wasn't called Al-Anon, but they had meetings, and they read the big book some. They talked about the disease of alcoholism, and they studied good books. And I remember asking lots of silly questions, but they were kind enough to answer my silly questions. I thought because he was sober, he was supposed to straighten up and get rid of all the defects and get fixed right now. And it took a while. And it took a while for me to see all of my defects of character. I found out along the way about untreated Al-Anonism. I have heard the alcoholics talk about untreated alcoholism, and that if you're living with fears and resentments and self-pity, those negative emotions, that you're suffering from untreated alcoholism. And I, when I heard that man talk, I was living with those things. And I thought, I must be suffering from untreated Al-Anonism. So I began to go around and ask people, what is untreated Al-Anonism? What are these things? And nobody would tell me. I don't know whether they were afraid to tell me or whether they didn't know. But it was necessary for me to find out for myself what my untreated Al-Anonism was and is. And I found out it was my defects of character. But it was the defects that I had, probably many of them from my childhood with my father, that I brought into the marriage and kept. And I made a list of part of my untreated Al-Anonism that I would like to read you this morning. Feeling unworthy and inadequate. Being a martyr. Being a fixer. I always wanted to fix everybody. Thinking that I know best. What ought to be. Being a people pleaser. Self-pity. Self-justification. Resentments. Fear. Reacting instead of responding. A mistaken sense of responsibility. Lonely. And many, many more. When I realized that the program of Al-Anon and AA could relieve me of this bondage of self and all of these defects of character, I began getting much more interested in working the steps of the program. When we had Al-Anon, we didn't have Al-Anons that had gone before us to show us the way. We just had a bunch of sick people, you know, gathered up together. And it was not too interesting, to tell you the truth. I wanted to be an alcoholic so bad so I could get into those AA meetings and find out their secrets and get fixed like they got fixed. So what I did, I went to AAs. And I asked them to teach me and show me. And Al-Anons didn't have sponsors then, but I used AAs as my sponsors, but I didn't say it because, you know, Al-Anons didn't have AA sponsors, but they had what I wanted. And so I went to them and I got help from them and I learned from them and I applied it and I grew. And then I turned around and I gave it to Al-Anon. And that's the way it was back there. Al-Anons were sad sacks. That's just all there was to it. They didn't have any fun, and they didn't have anything going for them, and the meetings were boring, and they would sit and read little pieces of literature. They had not lived the program to have the experiences to share that made life exciting. And the AAs were the ones that had it. And I just knew I couldn't lie and be dishonest and say that I was one when I wasn't, but I snuck in from the back door. And I also found out that UAAs didn't have any corner on God. And if I was willing to go to any lengths to get this program, and I was willing to do what you did, then I too could have that conscious contact with God. And I got the big book, and I made it mine. And I didn't use Bob's big book anymore. By the way, in the beginning of the program, when he wouldn't straighten up and do right, I would take the big book with us on a trip, and I would read him the big book, whether he wanted to hear it or not. I was a case. I knew exactly what he should be doing, and I would call his sponsor and say, "You better get over here. He is really acting strange." And Henry would come. And then one day, Henry got drunk. And I was beside myself. I was indignant that Henry got drunk. I didn't know people got drunk after they came to the program. And I could not believe, after all these things that Henry had told us and taught us, that he got drunk. And I tried to get Bob to go 12-step Henry. And Bob wouldn't go. So, you know what? I decided I would go 12-step Henry. And I did. And I walked in, and I was so mad at him. And I said, "I cannot believe you got drunk on us. I cannot believe you did this. I just want to ask you one thing, Henry. Did you make your conscious contact and your contract with God this morning? And he hung his head. He says, well, I don't guess I did a very good job of it. And I said, I want to ask you something else. Have you done a fourth step and a fifth step and a sixth and a seventh? I said, the very idea of you getting drunk. I was appalled. And I didn't mince any words about it. And he began to try to tell me how bad Anna Merle was. One of my friends in AA calls this razzle dazzle. He wanted to get my attention off of him, so he started talking about Anna Merle. And he started telling me that she was trying to starve him, and that she would not let him eat. Now, she was a wonderful cook. And that the only way that he was not starving was that he would sneak in the kitchen and swallow a raw egg while she was out of the kitchen. I said, I don't believe any of that crap you're telling me. That's the biggest lie I ever heard. I mean, I just let him have it. Henry said later that he was awfully glad when I left so he could have another drink. But I want you to know that Henry got off of that drunk and he said he was never going to drink again because he did not want me making a trust call on him again. But that's how crazy I was and how I thought I could fix people. After a number of years in the program, I really had a spiritual experience, and it was from pain that I had it. Bob had gotten on a dry drunk. Now, I didn't know it was a dry drunk. He had just gotten picky, and our communication was gone, and he was saying things like, I think you're confused who the alcoholic is in the family. Why do you want to go to those meetings when I don't want to go? Why do you want to go to the top of Texas? Why do you want to do this? I office with an AA member, and I have AAs coming in to see me all the time, and I get home, and I just want to lay on the couch and rest and watch TV, and I don't want to go to those meetings, and he did not want me to go to those meetings. This had been going on for a number of months, and it had gotten to the point that we could not talk to each other unless we were talking to someone else, and then I could get the message or he could get the message. That night, a couple of his AA pigeons came to see us, and so he was talking to me through them. And he was saying things like, don't you think it's ridiculous that Marceline wants to go to those meetings when I don't want to go? And I want to tell you, back there, Al-Anons did not go to meetings unless the husbands or the wives went. They just didn't do it. We didn't have that much freedom. We didn't know we could do those things. So he also said that it was my place to do as he said. And he got the Bible out. And he read in the scripture where a wife was to be subservient to the husband and do as he said. And all my Al-Anon went out the window, and I started crying, and I went to the back room and closed the door, and I got down on my knees, and I started talking to God. By this time, I had a pretty good relationship with God going. I had always feared God all of my life. I had been raised a Southern Baptist. And everything you did that was fun was wrong, and you were sinning, and you were going to hell. And I knew that I was going to hell before I started doing those things, you know. I didn't think I had so much guilt, and I had so much fear of God. But I had learned enough to know that God loved me and cared for me. And I had a conscious contact with God by that time. And God was the only one that I knew that I could talk to. And so I got down on my knees that night. I've heard it said in this program that if you don't get here on your knees, if you stay long enough, you'll make it. And I stayed long enough to get on my knees. And I talked to God. And by this time, I want to tell you that I knew this program was the answer for me. I knew that I had a living problem all of my life, and I needed a living answer, and this program was my answer. And I had to have it with everything in me. I had to have this program, and I had to have the people and the fellowship and the steps. And the thought of me not having this program was just like, it was like me giving up my life. It was a life and death matter with me. And I didn't know what to do. And I admitted to God that not only was I powerless over an alcoholic and powerless to keep him sober or get him to do anything, but my life was so powerless. I was even powerless to get to meetings. and I had to have them. And that my life was really unmanageable. Now, we were living in a nice house with a swimming pool. We had two cars in the garage, but my life was just as unmanageable as it had ever been. And maybe more so, because I had something I wanted so bad, and it looked like that I couldn't have it. And I never had gotten into the second step very much, because I didn't think I was crazy. You know, there wasn't that much the matter with me. I did some kind of silly things, but, you know, I wasn't crazy like the alcoholics in my life. But I began to look at sanity rather than thinking about the insanity. And I began to know that sanity meant order and harmony and peace. And I knew that my life was not insanity or divine order at all. And I came to believe that night that God could restore our marriage to peace and order and harmony. That it was absolutely insanity what we were doing. And then when I got to the third step, which I did daily. Daily I had turned my life and my will over to the care of God as I understood Him. But I'd left out one thing. I had forgotten to turn Bob over to God. You see, I still had these old ideas that I needed to fix him, and he needed help, and that I knew best. And I thought that being a good wife, I was to do these things. And all of a sudden, I realized that I had never turned Bob over to God. I had never really given God much of a chance with Bob. So I turned Bob over to God that night. And I turned the marriage over to God. And I turned my life and my will and my problems. And one of my main problems was, how do I get to meetings? What do I do? I knew that I couldn't fight it any longer. And God spoke to me that night in no uncertain terms and told me that I had been playing with the program. I didn't think I had to write a fourth step and take a fifth step, because my rationale was, I'm not an alcoholic. I won't get drunk. But I saw that I had been drunk on a lot of things. I had been drunk on self-pity. I had been drunk on resentments. I had even been drunk on phenobarbital back there in the drinking years. And I had that day and in the program been drunk on spiritual pride, that I had been drunk on a lot of things. And if alcohol had have done for me what it did for the alcoholic, I'll guarantee you I would have been drunk on alcohol too. Because I needed answers to life. I heard a woman in the program say that we are dependent only as long as we don't have answers. We can't release until we have answers. And then if we have answers and remain dependent, then we're in bondage. And that's where I was. I had some answers, and I got some more answers that night. And God told me that if I wanted any more spiritual growth, it was going to be necessary for me to get into the steps of the program at depth, that I had been toying with the steps. I had used what fit and what I liked and what didn't hurt, and I hadn't used the rest. And that it was going to be necessary for me to write a searching and fearless moral inventory of the exact nature of my wrongs, and to go to someone else and take that fifth step and that sixth and that seventh. And I became willing that night. I had a total surrender at depth, just like the alcoholic does. And I was totally ready to release the alcoholic with love. And I had enough of the program to know to do it with love. And that was before the word detachment came out. And that was before I had ever heard anybody talk about releasing with love to God. But that was my experience. After a couple of hours of all this going on, and I would cry and I would listen to God and I would talk to God, and then I would cry, and I had a total surrender. I even said to God, you know how much I need the meetings, but I can't fight it. And I just turn it all over to you. And if you want me to get to meetings, you're going to have to fix it up for me to get there. And if I can't go to meetings, you're going to have to put something else in their place, or I can't live. And I meant it with everything in me, and God heard me, and God knew. Sitting there wondering, she's really flipped her lid. She's really gone crazy tonight. And I didn't care. A people pleaser didn't care anymore what people thought. And I looked Bob right in the eye and said, I have made a decision. And he said, oh, you have? I didn't know you could make a decision. Because I hadn't made one since I'd been in the program. And I said, yes, I have. I have decided to turn you over to God. And you know what? He was so used to me managing his life, he didn't want me to do that. And he said, now, wait just a minute. I don't know whether I want you to do that or not. And I said, honey, I'm sorry. It's already done. I've already done it. And I want you to know that if you want to lay in bed and read whodunits for the rest of your life, rather than all these spiritual books I've found, that's just okay. If you don't want to go to church with us, that's okay. If you don't want to study the big book, that's okay. I want you to know that I love you just like you are, and I accept you just like you are, and I'm grateful that you're sober. I'm grateful that you've given us a beautiful home to live in, that I have a car to drive and a swimming pool in the backyard. And I just want you to know that I'm grateful and I love you. And I'm going to get about the business of doing something about me. And I really did. And I released him so completely that he thought I didn't love him anymore. I don't know about you, but I know alcoholics are this way, and I've always identified with alcoholics a lot, and I found out in the last 2 years the reason why from the adult children of the alcoholic meetings is that I took on the personality of the alcoholic as a child without the drinking. And so I go overboard. Everything I do, I go overboard. So when I release, you know, rather than the scales being balanced, I just totally released him. Just like that. And he didn't even know I loved him. He didn't even know I cared. And it took a year for me to see what I was doing. And to let him know that I did love him, that I did respect him, that he was wonderful. And I just left him so free that he thought I didn't care. So it was necessary for me to say the things to let him know how much I cared and that I loved him. But he was free. And then we finally got back in balance again. But that night, I began my spiritual journey in the program because I was free to turn my eyes inward and look at myself and take my eyes off of the alcoholic. And I really left him free. And I began to look at me. And I redid the first 3 steps of the program. And then I got to 4. And I wrote and I wrote and I wrote. I would go to people and how do you do a 4-step? And I did it every way everybody told me to do it. And it took me a year. And the ego got involved because I was going to do the best 4-step anybody had ever done, so I'd never have to do it again. And soon after I finally did the fifth step, then a man came along, an AA, and he talked about that you had to continue doing these 4th and 5th steps because you would uncover a layer and then you'd have to uncover another, and just because you'd done one didn't mean that you were... that you would know all about yourself the first time. And I got so mad at that man because I was determined that I wasn't going to do it again. And, you know, it wasn't but a year till I was doing another one. And then I did one on my marriage, and then I did one on my relationship with God, and then I just kept on doing them. And every time I did a 4th and a 5th and a 6th and a 7th, I got a little freer. And I was able to be me. And I was able to keep this conscious contact with God going. And I loved it. I just loved everything about my life and everything about the program. And along the way, I loved what was happening to me so, and I loved God so much, and I knew, and I had a new God. You know, the reason it was so hard for me to turn my life and my will over to the care of God in the program was because I still had some old ideas about God. And I thought that if I really turned it all over to Him, He would have me doing things I didn't want to do. And my greatest fear was that I would have to go to Africa and be a missionary. And I just didn't think I could do that. And if that wasn't the case, then I would have to marry a Baptist minister, and I didn't know which would be worse. So it was necessary for me to get rid of all those old ideas. I think it's better probably if you come in as an agnostic or an atheist, because you don't have all that stuff to get rid of. And I had to get rid of all that old stuff. And I had to find a God of love rather than a God of fear before I really could turn it all over to Him. And I found that God of love, the God that loves us and accepts us just like we are and forgives us and cares and understands. And I loved that God so much that I wanted to do His will. And I wanted to do anything that He wanted me to do. But I didn't know what He wanted me to do. So I got into the 11th step. And I began to listen and I began to practice. And I began to write things down that I felt like was God's will for me. And I began to follow those things and let the chips fall where they may. And after a little while longer, I decided I would make a commitment to God at a deeper level. And that I would meditate every morning using the 11th step. And anything that I felt was His will for me to do, I would do it. And I would do it first. And I want to tell you that my life has not slowed down since that time. It has been so full and so busy, I have not had time to sever the experiences until here's somebody else at my doorstep. All of the things that I call making a contribution to life have happened to me after I made that commitment. If you want your life to change, make that commitment. God, I also found out that we don't have to get good for God to use us. I always thought I had to get good, and I never thought I could be that good. So I always kept trying to get good, and then God would use me. And I found out you don't have to get good. And what a wonderful relief not to have to be good. Just be willing is all we have to do. And there have been some wonderful things that have come out of me following God's will for me. And maybe I didn't always know what it was. But if I was in doubt, I'd check it out with another person. And one of the things that I found out was that if it was things that I really wanted, if it was selfish things, that it wasn't God's will. God wanted me to do the things to make a contribution to life. And there's a lot of things that have happened. One, as I was the Al-Anon delegate, I could get some things going, and I got the Texas Al-Anon conference started. Just from listening, knowing that we needed that in Texas, just like they had it in New Jersey. Got a retreat going, that people could get together and have a weekend together. The butterfly story that brought supplies to the West Texas Al-Anon Assembly was written. There's a young people's conference that meets at Lake Whitney that has been going on for years and years. And as a result of me listening and following my directions, I didn't know it was going to be a young people's conference. And along the way, as I began to listen, I found out that there were two parts of me. And I kind of thought for a while I was crazy, but I found out a lot of other people have two parts of them too. And there was this, what I call the lower self, and then there was the higher self. And when I was meditating and I was listening to God, it all seemed so easy and so natural and so wonderful that I would just get up and do those things. And then I would come down from my higher state of consciousness into this world, into my lower self, and my lower self would take over. And it would say crazy things to me like, you don't want to do that. What would they think about you? And my higher self would talk back and say, yes, but I told God I was going to do this, so I'm going to do it anyway. That's the way the Young People's Conference got started. I had made this commitment to be true to God and to follow His will for me. And I had been told in meditation that it would be nice to invite a group of people, young people, down to Lake Whitney so they could get to know each other. And there were two young people that were coming anyway that we were good friends of. And it just seemed, yes, God, that will be easy, that will be wonderful, you know, I'll get out there and I'll do it. And then I got out of meditation, and this lower self started telling me things. And the things were pretty much the truth. And one of the things I heard was, you don't have time for that. You're too busy. You're the Al-Anon delegate. You can't go off and do things like that when you're the Al-Anon delegate. And I said, yes, I am, because God told me to. And then it got to my ego, and it said, you don't even read and write and spell correctly, and you know how bad you are at writing letters, and Grady is a college professor. What will he think of you when he gets your letter? And I said, well, I can look the words up in the dictionary if I can't spell them. And also, it came in, what will they think? Who do you think you are? You're a middle-aged person. Why do you think any young people would like to come to Lake Whitney and spend the weekend at your house? And I said, well, I'm going to ask them anyway. Little did I know that the news got out, and I was going to have 8 people because that's as many as I could sleep in my house, and I was going to cook for them, and I invited 8, and the news got out, and 22 came. And some of them had to stay at a lodge, but that was okay. And they loved the freedom that they had and the sharing that they had and meeting other young people and taking young people's addresses and carrying them back to their homes in Texas. But some of our friends got a young man out of jail and brought him and sent him down to us. We had quite a group. And they said, "This is so wonderful. Can we do it again in 4 months?" And we said, "Sure." So at that time, we had 40. And they said, "I don't believe we could have made it. I don't think we could have stayed sober. If I hadn't had Grady to call when I went to Austin, if I hadn't had David to call when I went to Dallas." So they changed names and addresses. And at that time, they said, "Can we do this every quarter? And can we call it the Lake Whitney Young People's Conference?" It was not many years ago that Bob and I attended one of their big meetings that they got together in, I think it was Memphis, Tennessee. And they started out, and they had the youngest young people's group that had been started, conference, not group, conference. And then they went back, and they told, "Well, I heard this one, and I went to Florida, and I started one there, and then I went from Florida to Michigan, and I started one there," and they are all over the country. And I sat there in awe, just absolutely could hardly believe what had happened from that little bitty group of young people that started meeting in our house. And I thought, you know, I could have just as easy listened to my lower self as my higher self. And if I hadn't made that commitment to do whatever I felt God wanted me to do and let the chips fall where they may, I wouldn't have done that. So that showed me that God is always trying to use us. He always wants to use us. And all we have to do is listen and follow the directions. And sometimes it does get scary. And sometimes that other part of us comes in and worries about what they will think and what they will say and what they will do. But I want to tell you, I found out it's a lot easier to please God than it is people. And that gave me another freedom. And freedom is something that I always wanted in my life. And it was wonderful to get a little taste of freedom here and a little taste of freedom there. We had a daughter, Sandy, that died about 8 years ago of cancer. She had 2 children. And the father had divorced her and remarried, and we couldn't even see the grandchildren for a year after her death. I had a wonderful experience with Sandy. Sandy had been an Alkene sponsor. She was 15 years old when Bob got sober. And we had been close because we stood together. When I went back to Bob, she pulled away from me as well as from him. And she was a loner, and she was an outsider. And we had a meeting in our home that might have been the first Alkene meeting before Alkene was ever born, from a very wise man in AA that was an educator that said, "Get all your children together, and I'll talk to them." And he did. And later, she became an Alkene sponsor. And after she went off to college, she opened herself up and loved the program and went to open meetings with us and lived a spiritual life. And when we found out that she had cancer and she was having another surgery, I went to stay with her. And I stayed with her the last 3 months of her life. And it was such a blessing for me and for her, for us to have the time together. And we worked the program together. And we took the first 3 steps every morning. And we asked God to take the illness and use it to help others. And that happened. And many, many beautiful things happened from the experience that we had together, as well as her twin sisters coming and staying with her a while, and also Bob coming and staying with her. We took her to Mexico when there was no help left for her in the United States. We went to Mexico for additional treatment. And God just led us every step of the way, and it was a beautiful experience, the things that happened to us. And we needed that time to get our relationship healed. Bob needed that time with her, and I needed that time with her, because she had felt so apart from the family for so long
that she wasn't sure that we really cared and we really loved her. She never had received the blessing from each of us. So that experience that I had with my daughter was something that was necessary for me to walk through. I knew that God was with me every step of the way. There was, even though on the outside there was sadness and there was much to be done, there was an inner peace within me and an inner joy because I knew I was in contact with God. I knew He was with me and I knew He was directing us. And the time came that it was necessary for me to offer Sandy to God and just say, whatever is your will and whatever is for her highest good and for yours. And I totally released her. And she had some good days after that. And she came to, and we could talk, and we could share. And I know that her soul chose to go on because she was getting well. And because of things that happened, I am very sure today that it was her soul's choice to make the transition and go on. And I had something happen that I'd like to share with you because some of you might have a circumstance like this in your life sometime. And a very wise spiritual woman that I called after my daughter's death and told her that I couldn't come pick her up and bring her to the hospital that day and what had happened. And she said, "Oh, darling, just sit down and talk to your daughter's spirit. She's there. And tell her anything and everything that you want to tell her. Tell her that you're releasing her with love to her higher experience, and tell her that anything that she wants done, to just let you know, and you'll do it. And release her, and let her know that you care. And all the things that you wish you hadn't done, tell her about them. All the things you wish you hadn't said, tell her about them." And I sat down, and I did that, and I told Bob, and I told my daughter Susan what I was going to do. And as soon as I did it, the peace came upon me again. I told you that my father was an alcoholic, and he finally got into the program, and I really don't have time to get into this story very much, but I learned through an Al-Anon to pray for my father, and I prayed for him daily for 8 years, and sometimes I didn't even mean it. Sometimes all I could do is say, "God bless him. He sure does need it." And I had really come into this program hating my father, what he had done to me, what he had done to my mother. And I learned to love him through saying prayers for him. And after 8 years of saying a prayer for him, I was at the right place at the right time when he asked for help. And he carried me back in his pig pen that was his drinking room that he never would let anybody in to clean up. And he was crying like a baby, and he was red-faced and stinking and unshaven. And he began to break down and tell me how sorry he was for the things that he had done to me and to my mother. And I understood him, and I loved him, and I cared. And I can't tell you how grateful I was to be able to say to him, "You're not sorry, Daddy, you're sick. And I know somebody that can help you. Will you let me call?" And I called AA that night, and they came. And they stayed around the clock. They stayed with him in shifts for 2 days and nights. They literally loved him sober until he was able to get on his feet and go to a meeting. He was 73 years old. And I saw the miracle of God in action through AA with my father that I wasn't around to see with my husband. And I never loved you more than then. And he had a year in the program. And we began to talk and communicate, and I saw this man totally change. I saw the fears drop from him. I saw him start getting outside of himself and caring for people and loving them. And then he was laid up and couldn't go to meetings, and that stinking thinking returned, and stinking thinking leads to drinking. And he started thinking a beer or two would taste good, and that wouldn't hurt. And he graduated from beer to vodka. And in 2 weeks, he died a practicing alcoholic. But I can't tell you how grateful I was that he had the chance and the opportunity. And he had the change. And that last drunk was totally different. He was not demanding. He wasn't hollering. He wasn't cussing. He just peacefully and quietly went on. And when my mother called and told me about it, I was out of town. I sat down and I talked to him. And I said, "It's okay, Daddy. You won't have to drink anymore." I can't tell you how grateful I am that I was able to get that relationship healed and that I was able to love and forgive my earthly father so my heavenly father could love and forgive me. I want to talk to you just a few minutes about the blessing. I have been asked to tell this, and it's one of my favorite things that happened to me in the program. I attended a meeting 10 or 12 years ago that was a spiritual meeting and not an Al-Anon meeting. It was a retreat. And this man started talking about the blessing, that it was our birthright to be blessed. He read scriptures saying that children's birthright was to be blessed by their mother and their father. But he went on to say that many people didn't even know what that was, and anytime he counseled with someone, he had to ask them, "Were you a blessed child?" Because if you were not a blessed child, you would go out into life looking for the blessing in the wrong places. You went out into life as an emotional cripple, and you looked for the blessing in drugs and alcohol and sex and clothes and cars and what have you, where we've all looked for it. And he said, a blessed child, it was not what you were given materially in life. It's that you had this understanding and feeling with your parents that you were loved just like you were, that you were accepted just like you were, that you didn't have to do anything to earn their favor. And that when you had a problem, you could go to that parent and you knew that you could talk to them and they would understand and you could get some help. It didn't mean you weren't disciplined. It meant that inside of you, you knew that they loved you and cared for you, and that you were a blessed child, and that you would always have that relationship with your parents. And he went on to say that for many reasons, we're not blessed children. And I began to think of all the people in AA and Al-Anon I knew and how few of them ever received that blessing at home. It's very rare that I find someone, when I tell this story, that says, "I was a blessed child and I didn't know how fortunate I was." But I began to look at my life and see that I did not feel blessed. I did not feel loved. My father, being alcoholic, could never tell me he loved me. And he just never could express himself at all. He could tease me and make fun of me, and that's as much of his attention as I ever got. And my mother was always busy with him. And she was from the old school that if you don't tell a child what's wrong with them, how are they going to shape up and get better? So I never got a pat on the head. I never heard her say, "You did a good job." And I was always knocking myself out, trying to do better, trying to be better, trying to please. If I made up my and fixed my room, she would tell me what was wrong. She would never tell me I did a good job. If I brought home a report card and I had a B, I should have made an A. I always should have done better. And I never felt like I could please her. And I cut myself off and became very lonely and never tried to go to them for anything because they were not there for me emotionally when I needed them. And that's part of what I found out in the adult children of the alcoholic meeting. This man went on to say that if our parents did not give us the blessing, it's not that they would not, it's that they could not. In other words, they were doing the very best they could according to their light and understanding that they had from God. And also, he said, quit going back to the dry hole. It can ruin your life. And I began to look at my life in the program, and I began to see that the first time in my life I ever got the blessing is when I came to AA and Al-Anon. And I don't know anybody that gives people the blessing like we do. And that's what hooks us. That's the attraction of the program. That's what keeps us coming back. We are loved and accepted just like we are. We don't have to prove ourselves. We don't have to be good. We don't have to earn any favors. All we have to do is just come and report and be here. And we get the blessing. And the blessing is healing. And then, after a while, we learn to know that God loves us and we learn to accept God's blessing. And then we can love ourselves. And then when we can love ourselves and know that we're okay and that God loves us, then we can turn around and we can be a blessing to others. And that is the most healing thing that can happen. And that's the way we get healed, is we are accepted and loved and we are blessed. My husband passed away in March of 84. And as wonderful a life as we had together, there were a few things that kept us from being as close as we wanted to be. And one of them was, I believe, that neither one of us totally felt like that we had received a blessing from each other. And during his illness, which was about 3 months, that part of him just left. It just got removed. That picky part, that part that was critical, that was hard for me to accept, was just removed. And I received the blessing from him like I had never received it before. And the twins received the blessing from him like they had never received it before. And we gave him the blessing like he had never received it before. And it was a very healing, beautiful time and experience. And because of the experience that I had had with my daughter Sandy, I knew what to do. And I knew how to walk through it. And I had all of my loving people around me. We both did, supporting us and helping us. And walking through this with us. It seems that the program has given me the courage to face the reality of life, the understanding of myself and others, and the strength to walk through it, keeping my feet on the ground and my head in the clouds. And I want you to know that I went through this experience being able to love and give of myself and caring. I got so totally outside of myself, caring for another human being. And I had the strength to do the things that needed to be done because I knew that God was with me. And I knew that I had received the blessing. And I felt good and whole and free inside. There is no way this could have happened to me if it hadn't been for this program. I would like to close by reading you something that I wrote that just came to me not long ago that is much the way that I live my life today. Whatever on a daily basis I'm willing to admit I'm powerless over and come to believe and know that God can restore it or remove it, then I will again have God's order and harmony in the situation or relationship. When I totally surrender it to Him, then He enables me to match calamity with serenity. Offering myself to God, all of me, and turning my eyes inward, getting honest, admitting it to God, to myself, and another human being. When I see these errors without judging myself or others, then I become entirely willing for God to take over and do for me what I cannot do for myself. So I ask Him, and I make amends, and check again to see where I am, and admit my wrongs, and forgive myself. Then I am a clear channel to seek God's will for me. I listen, I watch, I pray. I pray for the knowledge of His will for me and the power to carry it out. Then I do it, whatever it is, no matter how ridiculous it seems. If in doubt, I check it out with another person. Then I trust and am in tune with my Father. I let the chips fall where they may. I will continue following the dictates of my higher power, and I will continue to live in a beautiful and wonderful world regardless of my present circumstances that are for me to walk through and learn my lessons from, because the knower within me knows that this life is only a parenthesis in eternity and we're all going home together. God bless you, and I love you all.